Okay, it is 9:02 by the infamous Kerman clock. So, Lauren, would you mute the lines, please? Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the first telebrief of 2022, which is hard to say and believe, but nevertheless, here we are. Okay, I wanted to start off with ocean news. As most of you know, on Friday, January the 7th, 2 days from now, there will be oral arguments at the Supreme Court on OSHA's vaccination mandate. And I wanted to give you some context as to how we got here, what's expected of employers, and essentially the status of this whole vaccination issue. So you know that employers with 100 or more employees were obligated by virtue of a emergency temporary standard, which was published and promulgated by OSHA on November the 5th, a couple months ago, to have all of their employees vaccinated or in the alternative tested on a weekly basis. And what happened was, once that was promulgated, there were petitions filed in the Fifth Circuit, which includes Texas, to stay that vaccination mandate, which the Fifth Circuit promptly did. Because this involved the whole country, eventually, according to federal procedure, the case was handed off to the Sixth Circuit under the so-called multi-district litigation rules. And in a 2-1 decision on December the 17th, the Sixth Circuit dissolved the Fifth Circuit's stay of OSHA's temporary emergency standard. And then once the Sixth Circuit communicated its decision, there were emergency petitions filed with Justice Kavanaugh at the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court scheduled oral arguments for January 7th, as I said, coming up this Friday, to decide whether or not to abandon the OSHA temporary or emergency standard, or whether to stay enforcement of that standard as the petitions are seeking. So there will be oral arguments this Friday. Probably if you want to tune in to hear oral arguments, you can do so. I really have no idea what the court is going to do with this. Obviously, on the one hand, the history of OSHA is that it has been afforded great deference by courts in looking out for the health and welfare of American workers. And on the other hand, it's not improbable, it seems to me, that given the composition of the court, they may decide that OSHA exceeded the bounds of its discretion in promulgating this rule. So I do not understand or cannot predict what this court will do, but I do think it will render a decision fairly quickly, one way or the other, knowing that in the balance lies either obligations of employers to comply with the emergency standard or not to comply with it if they happen to strike it down as beyond the bounds of discretion of OSHA. In the meantime, the standard is in effect. And while the original promulgation of the standard required compliance by December the 6th, OSHA has basically continued those according to the following statement, which they set forth. So they said, to account for any uncertainty created by the stay, OSHA is exercising enforcement discretion with respect to compliance dates of the ETS to provide employers, with sufficient time to come into compliance. OSHA will not issue citations for noncompliance with any requirements of the ETS before January the 10th, and will not issue citations for noncompliance with the standards testing requirements before February the 9th, so long as an employer is exercising reasonable good faith efforts to come into compliance with the standard. OSHA will work closely with the regulated community to provide compliance assistance. So as it stands right now, even though there is oral argument scheduled for this coming Friday, those of you out there with employee complements of 100 or more employees really should be in the midst of preparation for compliance, because you can't count on the fact that the Supreme Court will nix the standard. And of course, you need to decide which you're going to comply with in terms of are you going to insist on vaccination or testing or some combination of them. I can tell you that on the OSHA website, they have frequently asked questions. If those of you out there are at least ostensibly at this point covered by the standard, they also have a template for a policy, which I find to be pretty helpful too. So you can find both frequently asked questions as well as a template for a policy if you would ostensibly be covered by the standard. And of course, I know that there will be a lot of publicity on Friday about how the justices may be leaning. And so those of you who ostensibly would be covered may get some hint of that. But in the interim, if you have 100 or more employees and there's no Supreme Court decision, the emergency temporary standard, at least for now, would be in effect, and you need to pay attention to the requirements for compliance unless and until the Supreme Court stays enforcement of the OSHA standard. So stay tuned. I'll probably cover this one way or another in the February telebrief, but I wanted to bring this to your attention. I also wanted to cover, in connection with COVID and obligations of employers, a sort of very recent pronouncement of OSHA regarding and the EEOC regarding disabilities under COVID, which was communicated in a formal way by the EEOC on December the 14th. So on December the 14th, the EEOC put out a guidance having to do with the connection between COVID issues and the ADA. And it started out again by articulating that whether an impairment is a disability, of course, is a fact-specific question dependent on the physical and mental condition of the employee and his or her abilities and restrictions. So in the guidance, the EEOC says that a person who is infected with COVID but is asymptomatic, or a person whose COVID-19 results in mild symptoms similar to those of a common cold or flu that resolve in a matter of weeks with no other consequences, would not have or perceived to be have a disability within the meaning of the ADA. On the other hand, the EEOC states, an employee who has symptoms for several weeks or months may be considered disabled. But again, this would be determined on a case-by-case basis. So the guidance promulgated by the EEOC goes on to note that COVID-19 is a mental or physical impairment because it's a physiological condition affecting at least one bodily system. So the main question, says the EEOC, whether an employee's COVID-19 condition is whether it substantially limits at least one major life activity. And they go on to provide examples of when an employee's COVID-19 symptoms substantially limit a major life activity. So they say an individual diagnosed with COVID-19 who experiences ongoing and intermittent headaches, dizziness, brain fog, and difficulty communicating, which the employee's doctor attributes to COVID-19, is considered to be disabled because the employee is substantially limited in the major life activity of brain functioning, concentrating, and or thinking. Secondly, they go on to say an individual diagnosed with COVID-19 who initially receives supplemental oxygen for breathing difficulties and has shortness of breath, associated fatigue, and other COVID-19 related effects that last or expected to last for several months is substantially limited in respiratory function and possibly major life activities involving exertion, such as walking. Third, an individual diagnosed with COVID-19 who experiences heart palpitations or chest pain, shortness of breath, and related effects due to COVID-19 that last or expected to last for several months is substantially limited in cardiovascular function and circulatory function. And last, the EOC is an individual diagnosed with long COVID who experiences COVID-19 related intestinal pain, vomiting, and nausea that linger for many months, even intermittently, is substantially limited in gastrointestinal function, among other life activities. Then, conversely, the EOC provides examples of when an employee's COVID-19 symptoms do not substantially limit a major life activity. So they say an individual diagnosed with COVID-19 who experiences congestion, sore throat, fever, headaches, and or gastrointestinal discomfort, which resolve within several weeks, but experiences no further symptoms or effects, is not substantially limited in a major bodily function or other major life activity and does not have an actual disability under the ADA. And secondly, they say an individual infected with COVID-19 but who is asymptomatic is not substantially limited in a major bodily function or major life activity and therefore does not have an actual disability, under the ADA. So essentially what the EEOC is saying is that like any other perceived or possible disability under the ADA, you really need to look at these on an individual basis. And as I've said in prior telebriefs before, sometimes the safer course of action for an employer is to assume, for the purposes of argument, that a certain set of symptoms or conditions may be considered as a disability under the ADA, and then move on to the second part of the inquiry, which is there a reasonable accommodation that is necessary or appropriate under the circumstances? Many times you can assume that something is a disability for purposes of the ADA, but then in the second part of the analysis, the question becomes, is there a reasonable accommodation? Or conversely, does something impose an undue burden on the employer, either because of excessive cost, excessive administrative burden, staffing, or operational issues, in which case, even if you assume that something of a condition is a ADA-covered disability, nevertheless, as an employer, you still can't accommodate reasonably the particular disability. So I know that just from my own interaction with clients in the past 20, 21 months covered under COVID, there are many situations which simply do not pose the issue of whether something's a disability, but nevertheless cannot be accommodated because of so-called burdens which are deemed to be undue or unreasonable under the circumstances. We certainly may see a spate of EEOC charges that relate to COVID issues in the next, I would say, 6 to 12 months during 2022, but I wanted to give you the landscape, at least according to the EEOC and what you may face in terms of the analysis under traditional ADA analysis. Okay, in a totally unrelated COVID issue, I wanted to let you know on December the 6th and 7th, just last month, the Federal Trade Commission and Department of Justice held a two-day workshop titled Making Competition Work, Promoting Competition in Labor Markets. During this workshop, again, there was significant discussion involving non-compete agreements. Lena Khan, who's the FTC chair, outlined specific agency goals for the Federal Trade Commission, including scrutinizing non-compete and non-disclosure provisions in employment agreements through the use of rulemaking enforcement or putting firms that allegedly conduct unfair or deceptive practices that may harm workers on notice. You know that I've spoken repetitively during 2021 on the emphasis that at least the Biden administration in its administrative agencies are placing on non-compete agreements. And my surmise that between the administrative emphasis as well as increasing judicial scrutiny, we're in a situation where you need to go back, look at your non-compete agreements if you have them, and make sure that they are drawn as narrowly as you can be. You know that I've taken this position and still take positions with clients that if you can get by with so-called non-solicitation agreements as opposed to non-competition agreements, meaning that you're not attempting to prevent departing employees from competing in the same industries as your company, but nevertheless, where you are seeking to prevent that ex-employee from soliciting or doing business with companies that he or she may have done business with while employed, you stand a much greater chance, even under judicial scrutiny, of having those provisions be upheld. So just a word to the wise, you really need to look at your provisions with some degree of skepticism, and if you need help on, you know, how you can make them narrowly drawn, then I think that that's a good thing for you to do. I also want to bring to your attention the fact that the Department of Labor under Marty Welsh, who's the Secretary of Labor, has given a clear indication that it wants to revisit the salary levels for exempt status under the Fair Labor Standards Act. You know, under the Obama administration, that there was a movement afoot, which never came to fruition, of increasing drastically the salary level that would be required in order for the white-collar exemption, such as administrative, executive, or professional employees, to be considered exempt, even if they met the duties test. And as I recall, under the Obama administration, the salary test would have been somewhere in the $45,000 to $50,000 level. Well, Secretary Walsh, who, as you know, was an executive with a union in Boston, has given clear indication that the Biden administration is going to be seeking a much higher level of salary test than the present level, which is about $35,000 a year. Whether it will come to fruition or not remains to be seen. But I think, again, as we enter the new year, it would be wise for all of you out there who have job descriptions for your white-collar exempt managers, administrators, professionals, to revisit them. And if you're in that sort of on-the-fence level with these positions or close calls, to really take a close look at whether or not you think that these positions would stand scrutiny if the salary level were to be increased in the next 6 to 12 months. Now, remember, the rulemaking process is the Department of Labor would propose a rule, would seek public comment on those rules, and then ultimately publish it in the Federal Register. So it would take some time. So it's not something that you have to look at in the next 2 weeks, but I do think it bears looking at from the standpoint of prudence, because I do think there will be a movement afoot in 2022 to increase those salary levels. The last thing I wanted to mention is a decision that came out of the Fifth Circuit on November the 2nd in a case called Gezu, G-E-Z-U, versus Charter Communications. Essentially, in this case, it involved a so-called mailbox rule for electronic communications. Just to explain, under common law and under the so-called mailbox rule, employers or people who would mail things would have the presumption that those mailed pieces of whatever they were would get to their recipient in the normal course of a day or two. That's a so-called mailbox rule. Well, with electronic communications, many employers today utilize emails to notify employees of various updates in, let's say, a policy manual or standalone policy, et cetera. What the Fifth Circuit did in this Gezu case was to affirm the so-called mailbox rule for electronic communications. Those of you out there who use electronic communications, which is probably most, if not all of you, to update policies or whatever, can be heartened by the decision in this case. And generally what it stands for is if you have the ability to affirm that the email was sent out in the regular course of business, that, for instance, if you have an email delivery receipt indicating that employees got the email even if they didn't read it, that generally courts will uphold the presumption that if it was emailed in the normal course of events, that it was received by employees in the normal course of events, whether they say they didn't read it or they didn't get it or not. So it's a useful case, stands for a useful proposition, and those of you out there who regularly use emails to update policies, et cetera, can be optimistic about a court giving deference to you utilizing email communications and making sure that there's a presumption that if it was emailed on a certain day, that it was received that day by employees. Okay, those are the developments for the day. Lauren, can you take this off on mute, please?
I did, and I have the vaccination.
Okay, as I always say, if you have any questions, yeah.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you, Howard. This is Kathy. I wonder if we've got a predominantly remote workforce currently, and under the OSHA ETS, can we, instead of requiring testing weekly, require that they only test when they are going to have to come on site or meet with a client?
Kathy, the answer to that is yes, that if you go on the frequently asked questions on the OSHA website, it's clear that even if the emergency temporary standard is applicable, in other words, if the Supreme Court puts its imprimatur on it, that it would not apply to those employees who work remotely anyway or are not required to come in, and would only be applicable to those employees who are required to physically come in. So the answer to your question is you're okay.
Thank you.
Sure. Any other questions out there? Okay, well, as I said, I think the Supreme Court's oral arguments will be online, just as the abortion case out of Mississippi was online. So I welcome you to listen in on Friday to see if you can read the tea leaves any better than I can once the Supreme Court hears these oral arguments. So anyway, be safe, continue to hopefully be COVID-free, and we'll talk in February. Thanks a lot, everybody.